That's right. Stop it. Stop them. Call a halt to those presses for crying out loud. 720 WGN, 10 minutes after 8 o'clock. It's Corey Rumor from the Chicago Tribune. Good evening and welcome again.
Hey, John. How are you? Thank you for having me.
You know I love it. I came up with a little title today. You know, we had the rumor.
Oh, really?
The rumor report was on for a while, but I guess I stopped saying that for, I don't know why. Corey's Stories, or Stories from Corey. Yes.
Oh, great. My gosh.
I can see the T-shirts. I mean, you know.
Okay, can I feel that?
Sure. Absolutely. Come on.
That's perfect. Thank you.
Oh, sure. Hey, anything I can do to help, you know. I'm always there to back our journalists in their time of need. So,
yes, thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. So,
how have you been?
Oh, just fine, thank you. And how are you? How are you and your family?
Everybody's good. Yeah.
Okay. Getting all situated for the festivals of whatever coming up within the next few weeks.
Yeah, yeah. My kiddo's birthday was last week, and so I feel like December is just, it starts, and it's just, yeah, before I know it, it's February, so.
Yeah, and exactly, you know, and I know other people have experienced this, like, how old is your son, if you don't mind me asking? Is he 9 or something?
Oh, sure,
like that?
Sure. He just turned 11.
Oh, 11. Okay, well, I think, yeah. I think still at 11, I thought that it took forever to get to Christmas. When is Christmas?
Yeah.
It takes such a long time. Now it's like it's here already. It was just like here yesterday. I mean,
exactly.
The concept of the time is varies with your age, I guess.
That is the interesting thing to me is, how fast it goes. I mean, he literally said the night of his birthday, "Mom, okay, so here's what I want for Christmas." And it's like, dude, you got like 20-some days. You have plus, come on. You just got a birthday present.
Well,
he's
very
thankful and appreciative. But
sure.
It's like, yeah, it's like, give me more.
Well, having a birthday in December, my nephew Will, his birthday is 2 days after Christmas. So, it's something to be dealt with. But, I mean, it's not a tragedy or anything, but it's a little different.
That's rough.
You got to
say
it's rough.
I mean, these December birthdays, they have to wait all year. And the other thing, especially for kids who are like, of this age, it's not like if you don't have your birthday in the summer where you can go to the beach or you can plan an outdoor birthday party. You got to get a little creative with it because you have no idea what the weather is going to be like.
Exactly. Couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
Or couldn't agree with you, Rumor, as they say. Hey, now.
Okay, will you be my agent, John? You're really good at this.
So, I was looking at the variety of stories, and I figure here we are, the holiday season, Christmas coming up. We just played the Green Bay Packers. There's a couple of stories about that. And I think, taking a look at the Marshall Field State Street store, or what was the Marshall Fields State Street store, I think there are many, many, many Chicagoans to this day who just are disappointed, and that may not be a strong enough word, in the changes that have gone on over there. I mean,
absolutely.
It's like, it seems to me like, if they could take the clock down, they would. You know what I mean? The Walnut Room, and I mean, the windows, and everybody looked forward to that. I mean, it was a destination for families to come down and take a look. And your article not only deals with the way it is now, but traces it all the way back to 1868 through 1871 through 1907. I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's
what
interesting
history.
To me how, so many generations, like you said, this was the place to go to shop. especially for the holidays. And you're right. I think so many of us have missed that Marshall Field's name, even though I know there are still plaques on the outside that say Marshall Field and Company. So many of us have missed that. And I just wanted to look back and kind of trace, like, how long has this been a thing with Chicagoans? And yeah, it's been a thing for a really long time.
A really long time.
Yeah.
And some interesting facts in here. I didn't know this. July 1929, when Fields acquired Seattle-based chain Frederick & Nelson Company, it also acquired the Franco Mint. The mint was originally called Franco. I'm sorry, Frango Mint. The mint was originally called Franco in honor of Spanish dictator Francisco Franco? No.
Oh, no, no. I think it was called Franco, but then when he was on the rise, they're like, oh, we better change this.
We're going to name our chocolate after dictators. Come on now.
Yeah, maybe that would have boosted sales or not boosted sales. Who's to know, right? Controversial stuff.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't know. I've always loved Frango Mint. And whenever I travel somewhere else, that's what I bring to people.
Exactly.
And I had no idea that it wasn't something that began in Chicago. I didn't realize that it began in Seattle. But, yeah, that just goes to show, like, once it got here, everybody associated it with Marshall Field and with Chicago.
Am I wrong in saying that they made them at the store?
You're not wrong at all.
Wow.
Yes, they were made on the 13th floor.
Amazing.
of the State Street Marshall Fields. Yes, back when the entire building was just Marshall Fields. They were made on site for a very long time. It wasn't until 1999 that the candy kitchen part of it was closed and they were made off site. And the mint themselves have gone through a variety of owners, but you can find them in Macy's stores. You can find them on State Street. And I think now Garrett, the popcorn brand here in Chicago, owns it as well. So if you're sending popcorn to loved ones for the holiday season or whatever, you can tack on a box of Frango Mints as well. So
good to
know. It's good. It's very good to know. And it's good that the ownership has stuck here in Chicago.
More with Corey. More Corey stories when we come back on 720 WGN. That's right. 720 WGN, John Landecker, and from the Tribune, Corey Remore. And where do you want to go next? You want to go to the...
I'll go anywhere you want to go, John.
How about the International Livestock Exposition?
Yes. I love this. And you know what? When I go through the archives, I find folder after folder after folder about the International Livestock Exposition. So this is a story I've been wanting to put together for a while.
Well, give us a little bit of the background on it, for the city they called the Hog Butcher for the World.
Yeah, it's really interesting. As we all know, there were the Union Stockyards on the south side, and somebody had the great idea, well, we have, you know, all of these animals here, we have all of these packers here, and by packers, I don't mean the packers up in Wisconsin, I mean the people who process the meat and get it all packed up and put it on railroad cars and send it all over the United States. And so somebody had the bright idea, why don't we do kind of a convention of sorts where all of these people involved with these different groups can come together and kind of see the best of the best and, you know, take some classes on how to do different things. We can share technology. We can share different techniques. And so that's how the International Livestock Exposition came to be. And so it lasted here in Chicago for 75 years. And it's something that when you think of the city, it might not be the the first convention you would think of that would be here. And the other crazy thing about it is that it would always take place in November or December. And I was talking with my colleagues about that, like, why November and December? And our thought was, well, farmers and other people, maybe it's the only time of year that they can get away and can come to the big city.
No, no, there's a lot to that. My mom's father was a farmer, and I have relatives who are farmers, and you didn't see them at all during the warmer months. I mean, they were working. I mean, the only time that they could even take, and even when it was like the holidays, it wasn't like, oh, come on, let's go away and visit somebody. They didn't like do all the work that they did during the summer, but they still had responsibilities to the animals and everything else. They never really had a day off.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, that is a really, really hard life.
It is.
So I think that's why, November and December, the very first one took place December 1st, 1900. And when the International Amphitheater opened, that's where it was based because it was so close to the Union Stockyards. I mean, we are talking about tens of thousands of people, tens of thousands, heads of cattle and sheep, and eventually a horse show was added and a grain show was added. So you're talking about all of these people working in the agricultural industry and their families coming to Chicago before the holidays to be part of this show. And it was huge for a really long time. And unfortunately, when the stockyard shut down in 1971, then attendance dwindled. And so by, I believe, 1975 was the last one in the city of Chicago. But if you can go to chicagotribune.com, my colleague Marianne Mather found, like I said, we had bunches and bunches and bunches of photos from this livestock exposition that took place every year. I mean, everything from boys, you know, sitting with their cows, playing cards, to people washing their animals to get them ready to show.
Sure.
And so, like I said, it's not something you might initially think of with Chicago, unless, like you said, the Carl Sandburg poem about Hog Butcher for the World. You might not initially think of it, but it was a huge thing here for 75 years.
Yes, and thousands of people came to town for this. I mean,
so many, and it was interesting to look through the paper and see the advertisements for places like Marshall Fields saying, hey, everybody who's in town for the exposition, come and do your Christmas shopping here. So I think it was a great thing for the entire city to have this many people come to town and to eat dinner at the restaurants and to go shopping and to go sightseeing.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, I can't speak for all farmers, but for those that were not within reach of driving their animals to Chicago and shopping at the Chicago stores, there was a lot of business done with the Sears catalog, which was, you wouldn't believe it. It was.
Oh my gosh. I can only imagine.
Yeah. I mean, it was huge. And in the rural communities, it was bigger. I mean, it was just like the place to go for the stuff you need. And I mean, everything, gifts and just the whole nine yards. And if you couldn't come up here and, you know, walk down the street on a trip to the International Livestock Exposition, you know, you still had that sort of touch of Chicago when the Sears catalog arrived at this time of year. You know, you said that December 1st, 1990, the exposition opened and had more than $50,000, which in today's money would be $1.6 million. In prizes awarded for cattle, swine, and sheep.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's quite
and a figure. And then on top of it, I mean, if you won a prize, your animal would then be sold at auction as well. And then it would fetch a top dollar for whatever the market was at the time. So, yeah, you could potentially walk away from this with a lot of money. And it wasn't just adults. It was also kids. 4-H clubs participated in it as well. So, it was really an entire family could be involved. in coming to Chicago for the livestock exposition.
Absolutely. Farming, I don't know about it today, but back in the day, it was a family operation. Everybody had their quote-unquote chores.
Yeah.
Have you done your chores yet? I hung out with my uncle one summer when I was in high school, and I'm like, you know, I'm a junior or whatever it was, football player. You know, I've got it going on. And my uncle ran me into the ground with the amount of work that had to be done during the day. I could not believe it. I'd be passed out on the couch at night, and he'd be sitting there with a bowl of ice cream watching Johnny Carson. It was unreal. It was unreal. Corey Remore from the Chicago Tribune will be with us up until 9 o'clock, and we've got some other great things to get to, and that is coming up straight ahead. But right now, it's the bottom of the hour and time to get into the WGN newsroom. 8:35 at 720 WGN, John Landecker with Corey Remore from the Chicago Tribune, going over a bunch of great articles that you researched in the Tribune archives. And there's a really good one about the entire history of the rivalry between the Chicago Bears and the Green Bay Packers. And may I just say that November 23rd, 1986 is a day that will live in infamy. Because for those who are around here, that's when Green Bay Packer Charles Martin picked up Jim McMahon and slammed him headfirst into the Soldier Field turf. I don't know if they had real turf or AstroTurf or whatever. I mean, it broke McMahon's shoulder, and it knocked him out of the season.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was, and the guy was only penalized, I don't even think, he ejected him, yeah. The referee saw the act from a few feet away and a 15-yard penalty for the Packers and ejected Charles Martin. But, man.
It's awful.
Really ticked off. Just say we're really mad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and everybody thought, you know, maybe the Bears could get back to the Super Bowl. But after that, it was
And you know,
awful.
He did it in front of absolutely everybody. I mean, it was on TV. It was on national TV, and you know, there was no escaping it. But when I read the article, that was like, got to get to that one for sure. I mean, but it goes back. How far does this go back, the Bears and the Packers? I mean, it's the oldest rivalry in professional football, isn't it?
Well, I thought so, too, until I started doing some research, and it actually turns out the Bears and the Chicago Cardinals is the NFL's oldest rivalry. They started playing each other way before the Bears and the Packers started to play each other. So the other night when the game was on TV, the announcer kept saying, this is the oldest rivalry in the NFL. And I'm like, no, it is not.
Listen to you. Corey Remore with the sports trivia of the night. So wait a minute. Both teams were in Chicago then.
Yes, both teams were in Chicago. And it wasn't until, I forget when the Cardinals initially moved to St. Louis. I'm going to have to look it up real quick. When the Cardinals moved to St. Louis before they moved to Phoenix. It's definitely the oldest rivalry. Wow. Let me pull it up for you right here. So
I
we can
no
say,
idea.
Okay. Yeah, the Bears and, the Cardinals first played each other in 1920, but of course back then the Bears were known as the Decatur Staleys. And the Cardinals were the Racine Cardinals, not named for Racine, Wisconsin, but named after Racine Avenue, where their home park was, where their home stadium was. So yeah, it started way before. Let me see, when did the Packers and the Bears play each
Maybe
other?
Maybe they should
the
move Soldier Field to Racine Avenue. I haven't heard that option.
Hey, maybe at this point they will entertain any and all options, you know?
Wow.
So I guess it was only 1 year. 1920 is when the Bears and the Cardinals started to play each other, and 1921 is when the Bears and the Packers started to play each other. So it was only 1 year. So technically, yeah. I mean, I guess it would be one of those little asterisks at the end if you say the NFL's oldest rivalry, and the asterisk would be me saying, hey, wait a minute, the Bears and the Cardinals played each other first. So,
you know, the quote-unquote legend is that it was the Bears, you know, and the Packers in the oldest rivalry. And since all the sportscasters and newspapers and sporting news online and magazines and whatever have been saying it for decades, that's what it is. Because they don't want to put an asterisk and then have to explain, well, actually, it was like this. Because that's just a little, that makes it a little too complicated. This is like, clean... It's the Bears, it's the Packers, let's just leave it right where it is. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
You know? No need to
exactly.
Fuss it up with the reality.
I agree.
We can rewrite history. Everybody's allowed to rewrite history today. We can do our fair share. Come on.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, why not? Oh, gosh. But there were a lot of great highlights between the Bears and the Packers that you read about over the years. In October 30th, 1977, Walter Payton rushes for 205 yards, which is his second highest total of his career, and that was at Lambeau. And the Bears shut out the Pack 26-0. That's pretty cool.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And the refrigerator scored his first touchdown against the Packers?
Yes. I forgot all about that.
Everybody just zooms in on the refrigerator scoring a touchdown in the Super Bowl.
That's true.
You know, but the idea that he's made his first TD run against the Packers, that's got a nice ring to it. I like that.
That's pretty cool, right?
I mean, Dick is there with this guy who's a, you know, we all knew who the fridge was, and running back was not his position. And so, you know, Ditka, I'm just guessing now, in a sort of screw you game plan, watch this, Green Bay, sends him in. And they're like, what? What's going on here? And as they say, he lumbers into the end zone for the score. Yeah.
Pretty special.
Yeah, those were great times.
I know.
Not so much
fun
lately.
But at least,
fun lately. Yeah.
I know. Yes. And here, the interesting thing, and if you go to ChicagoTribune.com, I have the rivalry all put together so you can look through decade by decade how they've done it. And traditionally, like through time, the Bears were ahead in the race to 100 wins. And then in the 2000s, it kind of leveled off. Actually, in the 90s, it kind of leveled off.
Well,
and then
they had these all-star quarterbacks. They had like
the Packers did.
Aaron Rodgers. At the height of their careers, I mean that was tough to beat. What were we doing?
The Bears had a lot of quarterbacks in there, right?
A lot of quarterbacks. Yeah.
I feel like that's the other graphic that during the broadcast they always show. Like, okay, the Packers have had X amount of quarterbacks, and the Bears have had like dozens of quarterbacks. So.
You know, this is off on a tangent, but it really ticked me off. I was watching the, I'm a Big Ten fan. I'm a Michigan guy and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm watching Indiana and Ohio State play for the Big Ten Championship. And I don't know how many times the people doing the play-by-play would put up the graphic saying something to the effect of, Indiana has had the most losses in the history of NCAA football or something like that. Whereas Ohio State, look, they've got all these wins. And I'm like, enough. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was then. Now take a look at what's happening on the field. And yes. I was very satisfied with the outcome, to say the least. Sorry, Ohio State fans. Sorry,
same. Just, I know.
I can't turn my back on my upbringing. That's just the way it goes.
I have friends who are Indiana grads and even one who is a current Indiana student. And it's just, it just makes me so happy. Yeah. It's like breath of fresh air. You need something a little bit different. And what a season for Indiana. It's been fun to watch. And in fact, the Chicago Tribune Silver Football Award, which goes to the best Big Ten football player, was given just, I think, today or yesterday to Indiana's quarterback. I think his name is Fernando Mendoza. Let me look this up real quick.
Oh, I guess so the award was this morning, I'm hearing. Yeah?
Or this morning. Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, yeah. So it's just an exciting time for them, and I can't wait to see what happens in the playoffs.
When do they do the Heisman list the Heisman
candidates.
Pardon me?
I actually looked this up because another story I've been working on is about Jay Berwanger, who was the first Heisman Trophy recipient ever, and that happened 90 years ago this year. So I looked this up. I think Heisman is... okay, I'm on the website. I'm looking.
Don't worry.
If anybody else knows it, it's
Saturday. I'm hearing that it's Saturday.
Oh, it's this Saturday. Okay. So it looks like the finalists are Fernando Mendoza, who won the Tribune Silver Football Award, Jeremiah Love from Notre Dame, Diego Pavia of, is that Vanderbilt, and Julian Sain from, I think that's Ohio State. Yeah, Ohio State. So it sounds like, it's pretty exciting. There's so many local connections and local graduates from these schools. So not an Alabama in sight. So
how about that? How can we proceed? It's 8:47 at 720 WGN, and we'll do more with Corey when we come back. Don't go away. Look forward to someone named Bonnie coming on after 9. She will explain. It's 8:50 here at 720 WGN. John Landecker with Corey Bemore, looking at some of the great work that she's done for Vintage Chicago Tribune. By the way, I want to make sure we get this in. How do we receive what it is that you do?
Oh, thank you, John. Yeah, you can just go to chicagotribune.com and search for Vintage Chicago Tribune, and those are stories that I do every week. You can subscribe to the newsletter that comes out as well. You just go to chicagotribune.com/newsletters, and I'm the one that says Vintage Chicago Tribune. I also do Every Day in Chicago History, so you can find that on the Tribune's website as well.
Excellent. And all of those things I might add, very applicable to doing a radio program. Thank you. you've got a very interesting article about the 150th anniversary of the Holy Name Cathedral. And in the time that we have left, when I was reading this article, I'm like, okay, I get to November 10th, 1924, and it's gang warfare.
Yes.
Which really surprises me in a story about the... Holy Name Cathedral's 150th birthday, but apparently this took place directly across the street from the Holy Name Cathedral on State Street.
Absolutely.
Who's involved in all of this?
Okay. So it was the person who was working at the flower shop was called, I think, Schofield or Schofield and Company, flower shop across the street from Holy Name Cathedral. Mm-hmm. There was a guy named Dino Banyan who worked there. He was a florist, but also a bootlegger. And so he was apparently putting together flower arrangements for a funeral of a gang-affiliated dude when three guys walked in and started shooting him multiple times. And that's when everybody came running. And the guys got away, but it absolutely sparked a gangland war. And it's not the only one that took place near Holy Name Cathedral. In October 11th, 1926, so just a couple years later, Jaime Weiss, who was walking across the street from Holy Name Cathedral, and this is when two guys jump out and start shooting at him. And as it turns out, he, I believe, there were like some bullets that had ricocheted off the cathedral itself. And Weiss was killed. His driver was also killed. His lawyer was wounded. And so, yeah, it's kind of fascinating. Like you said, when you think of the cathedral, you don't necessarily think of gangland shootings, but that was the case in the 20s.
No, really. I mean, it's you couldn't find two more items at complete different ends of the spectrum. The Holy Name Cathedral on one end, and then gang warfare on the other. And, you know, I used to live near there, and I didn't realize.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Well, not then, of course. Well, actually, yes.
Yeah.
I was there in 1920.
No, you didn't.
No. I survived. No. and to think, you know, there's so much publicity given to the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in Chicago. Everybody heard of it, a million. But I've never heard of this before. And this is the idea that it's happening in front of the cathedral is what makes it sort of a different story. I mean, gang, you know, the Capone and all of the people that were here at that time who were killing each other. I don't know if it happened all over town, but it could happen anywhere. It happened in that garage on North Clark for St. Valentine's Day, but the idea that it's out in the street in front of the cathedral is just like, I mean, that just sort of blows my mind, quite frankly.
It's wild.
And it is.
It was interesting because in the Tribune, for both men who were killed, the church refused to host their funerals, the funeral mass for them, and which it kind of makes sense. It's like, well, wait a minute. Yeah. We're right here, but we don't want to be involved in this. We don't want any part of this.
You know, you also write, you know, I said it didn't have as much publicity. It didn't have as much publicity, but you write that the so many mobsters, it seems, were florists. I don't know. That was just on a tangent.
Yeah.
But anyway.
This is true. Good cover, I think.
O'Banion, the protagonist of the 1931 movie The Public Enemy with James Cagney, was based on O'Banion, according to your article. And a fictionalized O'Banion similarly appeared in HBO series Boardwalk Empire. Amazing. That. I mean, they've got the entire city to choose from to take each other out. It's not like it's like we specifically are going to do it in front of Holy Name Cathedral. I mean, it just doesn't make it's very strange that was the location because it happened more than once, right? I mean,
Within 2 years, twice within 2 years.
Gosh. Well, Corey, thank you so much for coming on. It's great stuff as usual. Always look forward to talking to you and, we'll do it again soon, okay?
I sure hope so. Thank you so much, John. I love chatting with you, too.
Thanks.